Please welcome Campbell McGrath.
Well, thank you, Jim. Jim's a really rare category person for me, which is a really good friend whom I've never met before, because for about 10 years, at least 10 years, Jim and I have had a very intense email correspondence, but until today had never ever managed to be in the same place at the same time, which is unusual in poetry land because it's a relatively contained circle of us, but we've never been in the same place, and I've never managed to get him to Miami, and he'd never managed to get me up here to West Virginia until today, so I'm really happy to be here to meet Jim, whose books I know and whose work I've known for so long. I'm happy, and I want to thank everybody else, too, who I met at dinner with, who took care of me today, the English department, and everybody for being here. It's a real treat to get out of steamy tropical Florida, where we don't have autumn, and get a little bit of autumn at least back. What I'm going to try to do is read for maybe 35 minutes or so. I'm going to read in kind of two halves, a bunch of poems from recent books and some new poems, and then for the second half to read from Shannon, which, as you were hearing Jim talk about, is a book-length poem, so you have to kind of excerpt it. So first I'm just going to read maybe 8 or 10 poems and then talk about Shannon a little bit and read you, kind of guide you through that book. I'm really mad now that I didn't bring my Paul Westerberg poem, of which I have one. But I am going to start with two new poems. And this first one is called Books. Books live in the mind like honey inside a beehive, that ambrosial archive, each volume sealed in craft-made paper, nutritive cells, stamen fragrant, snug as apothecary jars. Like fossilized trilobites or skulls in a torchlit catacomb beneath an ancient city, Byzantium or Ecbatana, or Paris at the end of April when vendors set their folding tables filled with lily of the valley beside every metro entrance, and the women coming home from work or market, scented already with the fugitive perfume of mugwets, carry handheld bouquets like pale tapers through the radiant, rain-washed streets at sunset. And then it is night, half the world ruled by dreams from which arise narrative forms, riddles, fables, myths, as mist lifts from mountain valleys in autumn, as steam belches from fumaroles in benthic trenches to whose sulfuric cones strange life forms cling, chrome-green crabs and eyeless shrimp, soft-legged starfish sung to sleep by that curious cousin of the hippopotamus, the whale, who, having first evolved from ocean to land in the ever-eventful Cretaceous, thought better of it, returning after millions of years to scholarly contemplation in the mesomorphic metaphysical library of the sea. We're all children of Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman in poetry land. This poem is called Emily and Walt, and it just takes the metaphor of Emily and Walt as our parents and just makes it literal. Emily and Walt. I suppose we did not want for love. They were considerate parents, if a bit aloof, or more than a bit. He was a colossus of enthusiasms, none of them us. While she kissed our heads and mended socks with a wistful, faraway look, she might have been a little, well, daft. And he, allons, my little ones, he'd laugh, then leave without us. And those friends of his. Anyway, he's gone off to discover himself in San Francisco or wherever, while she's retired to the condo in Boca. We worry, but she says she likes it in Florida. She seems almost happy. I suppose they were less caregivers than enablers. They taught by example, reading for hours in the drafty house, and now the house is ours, with its drawers full of junk and odd lines of verse and stairs that ascend to God knows where, belfries and gymnasia, the chapel, the workshop, aviaries, atria. We could never hope to fill it all. Our voices are too small for its silences, too thin to spawn an echo. Sometimes, even now, when the night wind blows into the chimney flue, I start from my bed, calling out, "Hello, Mom and Dad, is that you?" I'm going to read a couple poems from my penultimate book, Seven Notebooks, because I know that we talked about it a little bit today in our Q&A, and a couple, some people last year maybe were reading this book with Jim. So I don't want to ignore it entirely, although, as you know, when you, or don't know, but when you produce a new book, it's, you know, immediately all your past books kind of get lumped in a heap of the past. And the new book is so much more in your present mind. I live in South Florida. I moved from Chicago to Miami 15 years ago, and I wrote a book about 8 or 10 years ago called Florida Poems, all about Florida, South Florida, but I still continue to find Florida, so I still feel often as if I had been, you know, I feel like the movie Robinson Crusoe on Mars all the time. But there was like a weird creature that lived under the sand that kept trying to eat that astronaut who was marooned there. So I tend to find it as a really beautiful but still somewhat alien, exotic landscape. So I'm going to read two poems about Florida. The first is the natural landscape in Florida, and the second is the human landscape. So this first one is called Form. Ocean like beaten metal removed from the cooling pail, mark of the hammer and tongs, the smith's signage, grain revealed as by pressure of the burin in a Japanese print, substantial, bodily, color of agave, color of bitter medicine, translucent only when the waves rise up to break at the bar, fingered by sun to the texture of meringue or Verano glass. Miami is not famous for its seashells. This beach, continually eroded, is held together by borrowed sand, graded by tractors at dawn, willed into place by the tourism industry. But today, after a week-long barrage of northeast winds, it resembles the famous shell beds of Sanibel, though these are mostly bits and pieces arrayed in sinuous drifts, the frilled lips and spooned-out tails of horse and queen conchs, sponge tubes, varieties of seaweed and uprooted coral, tiny broken elkhorn infants, torn fans, punch cards, serrated discs and tribal ornaments, teeth, dismembered ears, and bleached stone knuckles of a skeleton seeking restitution. And the eye, from its cupola of privilege, scanning the wreckage to seize upon the unbroken cylinder of an olive shell, paired lightning whelks revolving in the wash, purple scallop overwritten with calcified worm tunnels. How does it know to seek out only perfect forms? The next poem is called Lincoln Road, and if anybody ever has gone to Miami recently as a tourist, you've probably been to Lincoln Road, which is in South Beach, which is the replaced other parts of South Beach as kind of Action Central in South Florida. And there's certainly no other reason to go to South Florida except to visit Action Central, by the way. So this is called Lincoln Road. And again, I don't know if the exoticism of the natural landscape or the human landscape is the more outstanding in South Florida. Browsing before dinner at Books and Books, checking out the new poems in the new journals, the vast glass panes thrust against by shoppers and gawkers on Lincoln Road emit a particular cautionary hum as they insist upon delimiting inside from out, tongued and grimed by the fingerless gloves of the homeless, bodies gesturing and melding back into the pyroclastic flow, someone considering black lingerie next door, bedside lamps of Italian design, something sleek to refresh the kitchen. Honey, a silver pasta fork? Tattooed dance clubbers and waitresses slaloming trays through the crowd. A woman selling jewelry knit from optical fibers, lurid as stationary fireworks. Pages of a Carioca newspaper turning, foil off a champagne bottle, golden against the tile, pink straws, the splash of modest fountains in common space, a baby in green hip harness staring back at me goggle-eyed, recording it all, like the tourists with digital camcorders, pre-editing their memories, and the ringing of cell phones broadcasting a panegyric of need with whichever hooks and trembles we have chosen in the darkness to answer. Of the many things I write about, we talked a lot today in our discussion, those bunch of you guys who were there. I write about American culture and American landscape and American history in various ways. And popular culture is, hey, it's called popular culture for a reason. It's very popular. And I'm going to read a couple of pop culture poems. I'll read a couple of rock and roll poems. Jim Harms is one of my favorite rock and roll poets, poets of the rock and roll ethos. I'm going to read a poem called Xena, Warrior Princess. It's an Abecedarian poem in which the letters down the left-hand side to spell the alphabet out in order. They don't spell it out. They iterate it out. A, B, A through Z, right? So the lines begin with the letters of the alphabet in order. And if you ever have to write one in class, the hard part you'll know is the Q and the X. So by calling it Xena, Warrior Princess, you've given yourself your X line already. So that's a little hint right there if you ever have to write an Abecedarian poem. Absolutely everyone is wild about Buffy, the vampire slayer, and hey, why not? Cute as a little blonde button, no doubt. It's just that I'm easily excited by chicks in bondage straps and chainmail jerkins. Forgive me, it happens that I dig Xena's thing. I go ballistic when she and Hercules hook up. Oh man, it's incredible what that's like. Pure gravy, 100% natural juice. I'm cranked just thinking about Xena killing all the extras in a flourish after the third commercial. Listen, it's not as totally screwed up as it sounds. My ancient TV gets like 60-something channels. No way is that full spectrum. I mean, it's opening another can of nuts altogether, but how can I be positive there's not some even more red-blooded queen of ambidextrous rubber swordplay out there? Some righteous cable access babe in skin-tight skins or tights or Neanderthal whatnot or silver Teflon space bikini or that black elastic rattlesnake suit Uma wore in The Avengers. Uma, the uber vixen. But what a movie. Woof. Some are born to run and some are born to rerun, Xena. So let's ride into that sunset together, babe. You with a posse of buffed-up gal pals. Me at my zenith of carnage and woo. Okay. So another shorter pop culture poem. This is called Woo. That poem ends with woo. This one is called Woe. It's unintentional slant rhyme there. Woe, not as in W-H-O-A, but as in W-O-E. Woe. Consider the human capacity for suffering, our insatiable appetite for woe. I do not say this lightly, but the sandwiches at Subway suck. Foaming lettuce, mayo like rancid bear grease, meat the color of a dead dog's tongue. Yet they are consumed by the millions and by the tens of millions. So much for the food. The rest I must pass over in silence. All right, I'm going to read two rock and roll poems. The first is from this book, Pax Atomica. In fact, it's kind of the title poem in that the phrase Pax Atomica, which means the atomic peace, which was a kind of, you know, the Pax Americana is what the Cold War was often called, but it could also have been called the Pax Atomica, in that there was the threat of global destruction that actually kept us at peace. This poem's called Guns N' Roses. And it's really an elegy for a friend who died of AIDS in the 90s in New York City, but it's also an elegy for the 1980s, I suppose. Guns N' Roses. Not a mea culpa, not an apology, but an admission. There are 3 minutes in the middle of Sweet Child of Mine that still, for all the chopped cotton of the passing years, for all the muddled victories and defeats of a lifetime, For all the grief and madness and idiocy of our days, slay me, just slay me. They sound like how it felt to be alive at that instant, how it was to walk the streets of Manhattan in that era of caviar and kill-hungry feedback, the Big Apple so candy-coated with moral slush and easy money, even the corporate heavyweights could fashion no defense against decay. All the homeless encamped over cold coffee at Dunkin' Donuts on Upper Broadway. Even McDonald's become a refugee camp for victims of the unacknowledged war fought beneath the giddy banners of corporatization as the decade spun down its drain of self-delusion. Where do we go? Where do we go? Where do we go now? What a glorious passage, a shimmering bridge embodying everything rock and roll aspires to be. Heroic and violent and joyous and juvenile and throbbing with self-importance and percolating with melodrama and thrilled and scared by its own anthemic power, by the kid on a scooter freedom and the hill a lot steeper than it seemed at first glance. What the hell? Rust never sleeps, live and let die, etc., etc. And whenever I hear that song become now a classic of the genre, even as it suffuses me with nostalgia for those days of malt liquor and barbecue chips, it gives me cause to think of Axl Rose in his purgatory, self-assembled from paranoia and Malibu chaparral, wrestling exotic demons, kickboxing with Jesus, binding and gagging his women with duct tape in the closet, much the way the heavy metal mentality of those times seized and militarized his music. Sonic warriors blasting Paradise City at the Panamanian dictator. Welcome to the jungle for the Waco cultists. Slash and Axel circling the globe, leveling ancient civilizations with power cords and teenage emotions from the halls of Mentholyptus to the shores of MTV. And if Axel appears almost Nixonian in his anguish, at least he's not Kurt Cobain, forsaken and baby-faced as J. Michael Pollard in the episode of Lost in Space, where Penny goes through the mirror to a realm of demoniacal toys, and that metaphysical bear monster, cousin to the troglodytes that chased Raquel Welch up the cavern tree in 1 million years B.C. Death in its many B-movie guises, so much gaudier than the killers that walk the streets among us, the needle and the dollar, the gun and the rose. And the last time we saw Tim at Bruce's place in the Hollywood Hills, he recalled the first time we'd all hung out together in New York, Halloween, 1985. Provincial immigrants tossing back bourbon and tequila. Tim holding a bundle of ecstasy for some dealer, a drug I'd never even heard of, which instead of trying to market, he handed around with cavalier generosity. Packets of powder doused in the tall cans of Colt 45 we drank as we walked the streets of the village amidst the disintegrating drifts and dregs of the parade, and finally a midnight show at the Ritz, some L.A. bands the girls adored, done up in blacklight fluorescence, dancing and stage diving, jubilant and hallucinatory, getting home somehow on a subway serviced by orange-vested trolls before waking to cold sweat and hangover candy and a day of recuperation and the desire to do it all again. Because there was plenty of time, we knew, or thought we knew, or were simply too stupid not to know we didn't know at all. Time to waste or kill before the crashes and commitments that would doom or save or cast us back into the tide pools of that westering continent. Tim was still laughing, hauntingly frail, but what I thought, looking out across the canyon, was how badly Los Angeles had aged, wanton and careworn, like a faded child star sickled with cosmetic surgery scars, still dreaming of a comeback, still scheming and groveling, as if to prove that nothing really dies in America, but is merely removed from the shelves for repackaging, coming back crisper and crunchier, cholesterol-free, as even Axl Rose is coming back, has come back, with Tommy Stinson on bass and a sideman wearing a KFC bucket like a Spartan helmet. And I wish that I could lay the blame for Axel's fucked up life on the feral orphanhood of the Pax Atomica. The alienation of lives begun with no expectation of completion. It would be simpler that way for all of us. But the world did not end in a vortex of toxic fire. The flying fortresses have returned from the stratosphere, and the missiles endure their nightmares mutely in dark silos, and we have no excuse but the arrogance of power for our narcissism, and no solace but the merciless amplitude of our din. And that was it. The moment had passed. Another gem or tear for the cut-glass diadem of passing years. Someone cranked the music up. Someone made a toast to the pool lights and glitter. And then the Pixies begin some riff-raff, fully surfable rifle shot of a theme song, announcing the ironic revival of our childhood, swaggering like Tony the Tiger atop a station wagon at an Esso station in 1964. Tony the Tiger back from the dead, eldritch and transcendent, rise, the immortals. Rise to grasp the silver handles of the casket in procession before us, Ultraman and Astro Boy and Mr. Clean and the Man from GLAAD and Josie and the Pussycats on the Rose Bowl float with their God Bless America batons a twirl, and then, cue the horns, take it down, break it all apart, and start from nothing to garb our nakedness with sheets of beaten gold, cozen us with grieving blossoms, anoint us with honey in the dry riverbed, and tell me, O great devourer, O master of thorns and ashes, where do we go now? It's very interesting when you write about popular culture with popular culture in your poems how immediately time and date stamp they become, because the act of Axl Rose coming back that was alluded to as a future tense activity is already now past tense activity, and Astro Boy is now coming out as a newly remade movie when I remember it from like 1966, you know, sitting in the basement. There is a strange eternality about pop culture. I'm going to read two more short poems, and then we're going to turn to George Shannon. This is a new rock and roll poem. I didn't bring my Paul Westerberg poem, but I did bring a poem about Neil Young. This poem is called Albuquerque, based on the great Neil Young song, Albuquerque. 5:30 a.m. at the Holiday Inn Express outside Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to Neil Young singing Albuquerque, a song like coils of unruly silver smoke across an autumn sky. At the desk, I drink my black tea, eating slices of blood orange, watching heavy snow settle across the parking lot like volcanic ruin on Pompeii, the ash fall of human suffering, an ether in which we are jarred and preserved as fetuses in formaldehyde. Last night, coming down from Santa Fe, moon rising triumphant over tiers of snowy mountains, variegated textures of the tree cover and the naked peaks, snow fields capturing variably tinted angles of reflection, raw silver or titanium blue, the highest altitudes skeletal as ivory, like sugar skulls lit by processional torches, startled, deer-eyed, oar-like light beneath fast-scudding clouds the color of icebergs, high plains running away to the south and west, velveteen indigo, tiny white wave crests of the distant ranges, and the road a thin whistle in deep silence. No, it was tonight. Another day, but this same night, almost past, almost dawn, but not quite. The snow is lessening, and even here in scrubland near the airport, there are peaks like rough buffalo humps near at hand. Low piney ridge like a graph delving towards its barbed wire axis, scattered forest on the slopes, much still screened by low clouds and falling snow. How prodigiously important it all seems, how profound and vital the inscrutable message of moonlight on mountains, the message of the night, which is planetary and elemental, the message of the blizzard, which I cannot decipher, the message in a song to which I am listening very, very carefully, spitting seeds into a plastic-wrapped cup, waiting for morning, or a break in the storm. That actually seems like a better place to stop and move to George Shannon, since A, it mentioned buffalo, and B, it's a poem about that same...